we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. I'm Walker Wildman. I'm your host of the program. The show is hosted each week by Rick Green and myself, and we're with you each week, Monday through Friday, with a re-air on Saturday. And so we're kicking off the new year. First live program of the new year. The reason I know that, Bobby, unless Rick somehow pulled off a live show last week. Did he? Or did he not?
It was pre-recorded.
Okay, so this is the first live show.
First live show.
Of the new year. Yeah, I know for sure I wasn't on the air live because I've been traveling really the last week and a half. So we had Christmas, New Year, and then here we are now. So good to be with you today.
Thanks for everybody's patience waiting for us to
yes. Again. Yeah, a lot of re-airs, a lot of best ofs, but that's what happens during the holiday season. Hope everybody had a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And our challenge for the year, and I mentioned this last January, is to combat and resist mediocrity. That should be our challenge for the year, and we'll kind of get into why. But let's turn our attention to the scriptures. Psalm 143 is where we are this week. Verses 10 and 11, teach me to do your will, for you are my God. Let your good spirit lead me on level ground. For the sake of your name, O Lord, revive me. In your righteousness, bring my soul out of trouble. That's Psalm 133, verses 10 and 11. What I want to highlight is verse 10, the first part. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. So that should be our petition now before the Lord, for him to teach us to do his will and recognize his authority and superiority in our lives. And, excellence, speaking of mediocrity in the Bible and excellence is a biblical concept. Excellence was God's idea. What did God say after creation? He looked around and he said, this is good. This is good. And so God is a God of excellence. He created order and he created good. God, by definition, is good. And so as believers, one thing amongst many, well, really one thing that if you had to sum up how we should live our lives, we should desire to excel in all things godly, in all things that involve godliness and righteous living. As believers, we should seek to excel in those things. And godliness and excelling doesn't just have to do with reading your Bible or praying. We should seek to do the best possible in all things, right? This gets into stewardship. We should seek to do the best that we can in all things. And I think this is one area that a lot of believers get wrong, is they think that if they read their Bible and they pray, that they're being an excellent Christian. And that's just not true. Because you can read your Bible and pray and feel close to God, but be living in disobedience in other areas. And you can be also exercising laziness, mediocrity, and passiveness in other areas of your life, which are disobedient to the Lord's teaching. So we need to do well in all things in our Christian life, because we seek to honor the Lord. We're His created in His image. He's given us this season, this period of time that He's placed us here, and we should seek to maximize it in honor of him and his word. So that's our challenge for this year, straight out of Psalm 143. Well, moving into some clips while we have this segment left, about 6 or 8 minutes left. The New Orleans terror attack, which was clearly a terrorist attack from nearly the instant that it happened, when you look at the evidence, the New Orleans mayor didn't mince words. I mean, she came out within hours of the attack and said on national television, this is a terror attack. And there are a litany of pieces of evidence that were clear immediately upon the attack happening that made it plausible to label it a terrorist attack. Number one, attacker was a Muslim, right? He had a jihadi flag, an ISIS flag in the vehicle. And he targeted a large crowd, New Year's Eve celebration. So it was like textbook terrorist attack, all right? Not very difficult to figure out. And so let's listen to the New Orleans mayor clip two.
Good morning. First of all, we do know that the city of New Orleans was impacted by a terrorist attack. It's all still under investigation. You'll hear more after me.
All right, so there you have it. That's the New Orleans mayor, just about a 15-second clip there. But she clearly states she was the first one to speak at this press conference in the hours following the attack. And she states abundantly clear that this was a terror attack. And you may ask, well, how did she know that soon? Blah, blah, blah. Look, all these officials had access to a lot of information immediately after the attack, including the fact that this guy clearly had an ISIS flag in his vehicle and clearly intended to harm and kill as many people as possible with this attack using the vehicle and weapons and firearms. So this isn't rocket science. You know, this isn't some, you know, trigonometry formula that you need to have double checked by everybody else. This was a terror attack. And it was clear immediately upon arriving at the scene that that's what this was. And so leave it to the FBI and the assistant special agent in charge that showed up at the scene. Because the special agent in charge, not the assistant, but the head honcho for the New Orleans office just happened to be out of the country. I don't know why when these tragedies happen, probably 25% of the time, the person who's supposed to be in charge is nowhere to be found. This happened with another incident of which I can't recall off the top of my head, but there was another incident where basically the director of this agency was like in like,
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
Yes, that's it. Thank you, Bobby. When Lloyd Austin was incapacitated in the hospital with a surgery gone wrong with a secondary infection, he completely out of it, by the way. And his number two was out of the country. And I believe it's a female. She had no idea that Lloyd Austin was out of commission, that he was not available to perform his duties. She had no idea. And she wasn't available on American soil to carry out those duties. So this is just bizarre that these things happen. But nonetheless, let's listen to the FBI agent that was in charge on this day, who quickly was replaced, by the way, in under 24 hours, or 48 hours, rather. But let's listen to her within probably 7 minutes after the mayor calls it a terror attack. Let's listen to what the FBI agent in charge on the day has to say.
Good morning. My name is Alethea Duncan. I'm the assistant special agent in charge for FBI New Orleans. As Chief Kirkpatrick said, we'll be taking over the investigative lead for this event. This is not a terrorist event. What it is right now is there improvised explosive devices that was found, and we are working on confirming if this is a viable device or not.
All right, in order to combat the ever-existent temptation at mediocrity and stupidity in 2025, what on earth is she talking about? This is not, she said, quote, this is not a terroristic incident, end quote. And then she later describes it as an event. So how do you explain that? And she was given, by the way, hours to correct herself, because many of the commentators on national television that were watching this live were saying, I wonder if she misspoke. Did she misspeak? I wonder if she misspoke. Did she misspeak? I mean, that was like the talking point. Maybe she'll come back and correct herself. No, she never did. Now, the FBI did through a press release. Hours later, they called it a terrorist incident, a terror attack. But this is the kind of like scratch your head, unexplainable stupidity that the FBI is engaged in. And if she misspoke, well, she's had like 7 days to correct herself, or 4 days to correct herself, whatever the timeline's been since New Year's Eve. Today's day number 6. So why hasn't she corrected herself? Well, because she meant to say what she said. Because the FBI, I don't know what kind of twisted logic they're operating under, what they're doing at Quantico, but I don't care what the excuse is, why on earth you don't want to acknowledge it. But it's one thing to say that we are the preliminary evidence suggests this is a terror attack, but it is still under investigation, and we will confirm that at the proper time. Or say, we're not sure what's going on here. It could be terrorism. It could be something else. We're not sure. We'll let you know when we figure it out. Which I would dispute that as well, but still, to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's one thing to say, look, it's really early. This attack happened within the last 5 hours. We're still trying to figure out what on earth is going on. We're not really sure. We just know a guy mowed down a crowd of people. He had an ISIS flag in his car. He tried to gun down the cops afterwards. So we're still trying to figure it out. We'll let you know when we figure it out. But to come out within 5 hours and say definitively, this is not a terror attack, is to blatantly lie to the American public. So I don't know why she still has a job. I really don't. So this is acceptable. So to blatantly lie to the American public on national television, when you know all the evidence is pointing to a terror attack, you say definitively it's not a terror attack. What kind of twisted mind games are we playing here? And you can give me all excuses under the sun. Well, we don't want to give ISIS credit on national television, or we don't give credence to, you know, investigative theories before we do our due diligence. I don't care what on earth kind of twisted investigative logic they are teaching the agents at Quantico, but this is so messed up. It's so messed up. And the American people are sitting around, if you're like me, and you're feeling like, what is this, a mind game? Like, are we supposed to look and see like that there's some kind of like hand signs going on behind the agent? Like, what are we doing here? And people wonder, why do we have conspiracy theories? Why do we have conspiracy theories? That's because our government speaks in code, and they lie on national television. It's so frustrating. So I tweeted out, I put out on X, that the first person to go at the FBI ought to be this agent. I mean, as soon as Kash Patel shows up, like, while he's walking over to the DOJ, to the FBI building on the 20th at like 12:01 p.m., he should call the New Orleans field office and say, hey, you know that agent that totally lied to everybody on January 1? She's gone. She's done for. I don't care what the excuse is. You guys have had 20 days to fix this mess and explain your error, and you haven't, so she's done for. No more. I don't want a demotion. I don't want a title change. I don't want a public apology. This stupidity is over. It's over immediately. We're not doing, you know, tricks to the American people and the media. Let's be honest. Let's be transparent. and let's call things what they are. And in this instance, it's terror.
Hello, everyone. Tim Wildman here with American Family Association and American Family Radio. Hey, our tours for 2025, our spiritual heritage tours of Washington, D.C. and Williamsburg and Boston, they're filling up. They're halfway full now. And we've never had a response quite like this. So what I'm saying is, if you want to go with us this year to either Colonial Williamsburg, which includes Jamestown and Yorktown, or Washington, D.C. and all the sites of our nation's capital, including Mount Vernon, or if you want to go with us to Boston and see the Freedom Trail and all the sites of the greater Boston area. If you want to go on these trips with us this year, it's time to check into the information and register so that you make sure you're on one of our tours, the one you want to go on, obviously. So go to the website wildmangroup.com, WILDMONgroup.com. Hope to see you on one of these in 2025.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the second segment of this edition of The Core. I'm Walker Wildman here. Hey, a few housekeeping items. Number one, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Why? Because you can listen to the entirety of this show at your convenience. You can go back and listen to past episodes, past segments, all with the downloading or the subscribing to the podcast. Just type in the name of the show At the Core on your podcast store, and we would love to have you subscribed to the podcast. Also, our Activate Summit, we've got a plethora, to use my favorite word, of events coming up this year. We're in 2025, and we've got many events coming up. One of them that I want to point out this segment is our Activate Summit 2025 coming up in June of this year, the 12th through the 14th. At Cadence Bank Conference Center here in the city of our national headquarters, Tupelo, Mississippi. We would love for you to join us, activate.afa.net, activate.afa.net to check out that event. Well, I want to introduce Michelle Webster. She's with us now. Her husband, Tom, was a J6 prisoner and is now serving time in Texarkana. There on the state line between Texas and Arkansas. And she's with us now to tell her husband and her story, of course, of what they've been dealing with the last nearly 4 years. This month will be 4 years. Well, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Walker.
Well, Michelle, we've been highlighting both pro-lifers that have been targeted using the FACE Act by the Biden Department of Justice, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and the same Department of Justice has been going after what we're calling J6ers, or people who were present on January 6, 2021 in our nation's capital. And they've been using broad sweeping powers, many of them questionable from a constitutional standpoint, and they've been targeting really good people and targeting them with prison sentences and, at a minimum, harassment and legal fees and large inconvenience for the most part. And we're talking probably thousands of people, hundreds that have been tied up with specific FBI questioning. And then I don't know what the number is. You'll probably be able to tell me on people that have actually been charged with alleged crimes on January 6th. But Michelle, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, Michelle, let's just kind of go back to square one. Tell us the story of your husband, Tom, yourself. Tell us kind of where this started and bring us up to speed in a couple minutes on what all you've been through.
Well, it's been a complete nightmare, especially knowing that my husband is a former Marine, decorated Marine with 3 overseas deployments, a New York City police officer of 20 years, never one civilian complaint over that time period. In fact, worked Mayor Mike Bloomberg's Gracie Mansion prior to retiring. He is a man of faith. He is my husband of 25 years. We just celebrated our 25-year wedding anniversary. And he's a father of 3. We have 3 beautiful children, ages 23. Our oldest daughter is a United States Marine. She's a sergeant, a diesel mechanic in North Carolina. And our other 2 children are college students and very successful in what they're doing and pursuing in their lives. And Tom really felt like he had to be there in Washington, D.C. on January 6th in 2021 because he's a patriot. And he really felt that he needed to be there as a former Marine, as a police officer. It was important to him to show his patriotism for the country. And when he got there to the Capitol around 2 p.m. after having been at the Ellipse and hearing President Trump speak, he was shocked. He was shocked because the American people that were there in support of the president were being attacked, attacked by Capitol Police and by Metropolitan Police with rubber bullets and toxic, noxious gas, flashbangs. People were bloody. They couldn't breathe. I'm talking women, older women, children. Many people were praying there. There were people of faith in the crowd. These were peaceful protesters that were completely abused by our own government, by police officers that day. And many people don't realize that. The violence that ensued was provoked. There was no trying to de-escalate the situation that day. On the contrary, there was escalation and an attack on the American people.
Well, let me interrupt you in a polite way. That Nancy Pelosi was caught on video, and I'm actually still shocked to this day that that video, number one, was recorded. Number two, it was leaked or released. But she's in an SUV being driven by Capitol Police or her protective detail. And she admits, she didn't insinuate, she doesn't infer. She admits, she said, like, this was, I'm paraphrasing, this was my job. Like, this was my job as speaker to make sure that this Capitol was secure. And this all happened on my watch. To your point about the security setup on that day, there still hasn't been accountability that I'm aware of on the absolute failure of leadership and failure of security that sets it up to a point, to your point, Michelle. Once again, we're talking to Michelle Webster. Her husband Tom's in custody now based on January 6th charges, but and we'll get into that in a minute. But that was a disaster. I mean, it was a disaster on multiple fronts to such a degree where everybody was in a bad spot. The people who were there protesting were in a bad spot. In many regards, the officers were in a bad spot because they're woefully unprepared. And then who gave the orders to fire rubber bullets, you know, flashbangs, all this stuff into this crowd, what was at the time a relatively calm crowd, turned into chaos.
Right.
So what do you know about that, about the just utter failure to have the proper assets in place to where things could happen orderly and peacefully instead of the chaos that we saw on January 6th.
Well, Walker, it really makes you wonder if the entire thing was a setup. And I think we know today that Nancy Pelosi is, in fact, responsible for the lack of military support, which was requested.
And approved by President Trump.
Correct. Correct. It was. And I agree with you. The Capitol Police were not prepared. Some even wonder if the Metropolitan Police Department even had a right to be there. I mean, they came in and they were the enforcers. They're the ones, that force that really started becoming violent with the protesters. Underprepared, they were in a bad spot. The protesters were attacked, and there's no excuse for it. And Nancy Pelosi should be prosecuted for her lack of gaining control of the situation. She openly admitted it. She should be imprisoned.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Tom, about your husband. Tell us how things transpired there. Let's say you started January 6th and then the days and weeks following. Tell us how things progressed with your husband.
Certainly. So Tom, being very upset and frustrated that the American people were being hurt, went up to the gate, and he was holding a Marine Corps flag in honor of our daughter, who is a Marine. And an officer started provoking, taunting him, looked up at his flag as if to say, "Who do you think you are?" And the pushes lunging over the barricade repeatedly, provoking him, waving him on, "Come on over, let's go." And then he punched him in the face, open-handed punch to the face with a gloved hand. My husband went backward, and then the flagpole naturally came down on the gate. Two more times he hit the gate. He never hit the officer with the flagpole, and that's undisputed by the government. At that point, the flagpole broke. This officer came over the barricade on my husband's side, on the protester's side, ripped the flagpole out of his hand. And then after that, a scuffle ensued. My husband pulled up his gas mask, kind of like a hockey check. And this officer had the flagpole in his hand at that point, shoved it in my husband's mouth like a horse bit, and punched him again. So for this 14-second altercation, my husband was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
10 years?
10 years. And his trial, unfortunately, was one of the first trials.
Wow.
And the judge really just threw the book at him. And it's despicable. He never hit this officer. The officer never reported the incident. He never went to the hospital and sought medical attention for this incident.
Wow.
At the trial, he stated that he did not think it was a reportable incident. At the sentencing, he never submitted a victim impact statement. He only asked for $60 restitution. And when the judge came in for the sentencing, he moved from the prosecution side of the courtroom to my husband's side of the courtroom, which was completely empty, right when the judge walked in and sat there alone, meaning,
wow,
hey, this is not right. So the police officer was put in a predicament as well. And there's more to the story. This police officer actually, a couple months following January 6th, shot and killed a man while on duty. And unfortunately, my husband's Sixth Amendment right was completely violated because the jury never knew about that police shooting. And there was no ability for our lawyer to cross-examine this police officer who was being investigated by the federal government himself to identify any bias, which clearly there was. Mm. It's an unfortunate situation, but my husband was not given due process. And for him to be in jail for 10 years for a 14-second scuffle, and clearly it was an act of self-defense.
Right.
Or the judge would not have granted a self-defense jury instruction for him. He was one of the few protesters that actually received that jury instruction. Mm. It's a travesty. It's terrible.
Yeah, there's so much to kind of pick apart here, and I know you've been living this for 4 years, and you know every detail, and you've been very involved. I mean, this is your husband. This is a very personal thing for you. But if anyone knows the details, it's you. This fact that this is a common occurrence, and in order to break down all the details, we'll keep you over in the next segment if you can stick around a little bit. But this going after people, whether it's the FACE Act and pro-lifers or people that were there on January 6th, when the alleged victims are the alleged, in this case, the officer, are really uninterested in pursuing it, to put it mildly. The same thing happened in Nashville at a pro-life clinic. I interviewed Mark Hulk about a couple weeks ago, and all the local police, all of the local district attorney's office, everybody, literally everyone involved with his scuffle — this was a pro-lifer on the sidewalk in Nashville at an abortion mill — all of them had dropped this. No one was interested in pursuing this altercation with a pro-lifer, but the Biden DOJ comes in and they revive it.
Correct.
Exact same thing with your husband. The officer was the officer with the Capitol Police or the Metropolitan?
He was with the Metropolitan Police. And interestingly enough, MPD suspended the case. When they interviewed this officer, they suspended the case. And to your point, Walker, the DOJ came in and said, "Who's this guy in the red jacket?" And they opened it up.
Yes. So that's what happens here. And this really goes against one of the fundamental kind of tenets of law, of jurisprudence and prosecutorial kind of judgment on which cases to pursue or not, is what does the victim say? I mean, if anybody has a say on whether this should be pursued, and in this case, I'm using the word alleged victim, meaning the officer, that's what they're alleging, that the officer was assaulted, even though that's disputed. But he's completely uninterested, and the department closes the investigation. That's textbook, let's move on. And instead, the Biden DOJ comes in and revives it because they want to go after your husband. And this is pretty much the case with all of these. I mean, the vast majority, there may be a few exceptions, but the vast majority of these cases, whether it's the FACE Act or January 6th, all the parties that have kind of standing to be upset and want this thing pursued are not interested in it anymore. And instead, the Biden DOJ comes in. So tell us about the Biden DOJ. We got about 2 minutes left in this segment. Tell us about how the DOJ handled this, because in many instances that I've heard, this was pursued with a vengeance.
Yes. And it was pursued with a vengeance because of who my husband is. Former New York City cop, former Marine, great father, man of faith. And Tom turned himself in on February 22nd, 2021. We found about on social media that he was being wanted. And after that, it was completely, jail, Northern Neck, D.C. gulag. And then next following year, trial, disaster, 10 years in prison. Texarkana, fast forward, October 22nd, he's in jail for 10 years. Direct appeal failed. Writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court, thrown in the trash. 3 times we tried to submit this for a change of venue, totally ignored it. And now here we are getting ready to submit a 2255 petition in relation to this shooting and Tom's inability to have his Sixth Amendment right adhered to.
What was the timeline between your husband turning himself in and then getting a trial date? Because I know with many others, now it sounds like your husband had a quicker trial date, but I wouldn't call it fast under any circumstance. What was the timeline there?
1 year and 3 months.
Okay.
And many of those months he spent in jail and the remainder in home confinement, meaning he could not go out of the house, not even on the front porch or the back deck, could not leave the home.
Wow.
And that didn't count towards his sentencing, by the way.
That's interesting and unusual. We're talking to Michelle Webster. Her husband, Tom, is currently serving time related to January 6th charges, which we're covering her story and her husband's story now. We'll get more into the detail and kind of where we are now with Michelle here in just a few minutes. You're listening to The Core here on American Family Radio. We'll be back in just about 5 minutes. Meet Kelsey. When she found out she was pregnant, she wasn't sure where to turn. But after meeting with the counselors at a preborn network clinic who loved and supported her, and after hearing her baby's heartbeat on a free ultrasound, she chose life.
When a mother looks at her child through a sonogram, it does something to you. I ended up deciding to keep my son, who is now 5 years old today. He's amazing. He brings absolute joy to my heart. I could not imagine life without him. Not only did they help me save his life, they saved my life.
By introducing a woman to her baby on ultrasound, a baby's chance of life doubles. If you have the means, would you consider a leadership gift to save babies in a big way? Your tax-deductible donation of $5,000 will sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours, helping to rescue 200 babies. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 on your phone and then say the keyword baby. Or you can donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to be with you today. I'm Walker Wildman. This is our last segment of the program live with our New Year's, New Year live edition, if I can get it out. It's 2025. And we got a busy year ahead. We got the inauguration coming up in 14 days. President Trump was just certified by the Congress, both U.S. House and the Senate, with the vice president presiding. So that's been handled, the certification, that is. So now you just got to move towards Inauguration Day coming up here pretty soon. And anybody living in this country with any, reasonable understanding of what's going on is saying to themselves, this can't come fast enough. And it's kind of unnerving to think of what Biden can do in the next 14 days. He's still throwing out executive actions. He's giving away these, presidential awards. And he can't go fast enough. And I know there's a lot of people that feel that way. We're talking to Michelle Webster. Husband Tom is currently serving time related to charges that were brought against him around January 6th. So let's jump back into more of Michelle and Tom's story. Michelle, you and I were talking during the break, but tell us these charges that were brought, because when you tell me your husband's serving 10 years, which the time he spent in prison and in home confinement is not being counted towards that, 10 years, that's a long time for a 14-second altercation with a law enforcement officer. So tell us what all these charges were brought against your husband.
10 years is a long time, and if he has to serve his 10 years, he won't be out until December of 2030, which is frightening. But there were 5 felonies and 1 misdemeanor that Tom was charged with. The big one that got him this sentence is assault with a dangerous weapon, meaning a flagpole that he never, ever came in contact with the officer with. So that's really the biggest charge, and what led to this traumatic experience for Tom and for our family. And, it's just been a long road. And for the direct appeal to fail, when we had a great change of venue argument, we had a great argument regarding his Sixth Amendment right being violated. And then for the Supreme Court to not even accept his case. Right now, the only thing we can do really is hope for his 2255 petition regarding his Sixth Amendment right, and also hopefully for Donald Trump possibly to issue a pardon, commutation, clemency, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And that's what we're really hopeful for.
Yeah, I agree. I think the pardon or whatever avenue the White House thinks is best, I think it's got to happen. Personally, I think between the January 6th victims and the FACE Act victims, I think that's like a 24 to 48 hour priority with the White House. I don't think they need to drag this thing out into week 2, week 3. I think it needs to happen pretty expeditiously, probably up at the top of the list with border security, et cetera. But we got people suffering like your husband in real time. I mean, this is not a problem that can wait, if you will. So I think it needs to be done pretty expeditiously on the pardoning front. But the charges with your husband, this is aggressive stuff. I mean, this is like, hey, let's use this against the cartels. Let's use these statutes against terrorists. Let's use these statutes against the mafia. But let's use it against a former law enforcement officer, former Marine, who got in a 14-second altercation. That time just... Like, what can be done in 14 seconds? The answer is not very much. But talk about kind of y'all's personal experience with the DOJ and how they've kind of treated you guys throughout this process.
Well, one thing that sticks in my mind is there were hearings every month, like status hearings. And every single time the judge asked the prosecution, is there any evidence of a provocation or a punch? And they lied and they said no. And all that time, they had a stationary Capitol camera showing the punch and the provocation on video. And they lied to the judge.
Coming from the officer, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Coming from the officer. So this is prosecutorial misconduct. They've committed fraud on the court between not allowing that shooting to be discussed. The case, they said, was closed. It's still open. It's been open until October 24th of this year. So the lies that the prosecution has told have saddled my husband with this 10-year sentence. He was completely overcharged, and the judge called this punch to the face a touch. Mr. Webster, you were not hit, you were touched. Meanwhile, an FBI agent sworn testimony said that my husband was struck. And this is the same FBI agent, not informant, that testified that he was inside the Capitol that day in tan tactical clothing.
Wow.
So when people say, oh, there were informants there, no, there were agents there.
Absolutely.
There were lettered agencies,
They're intentionally using confusing terminology.
Correct.
The Inspector General report that said 26, I don't know whether they use the word informant. I think they use the word informant. 26 informants were there on January 6th. Well, that's not clear. Either you're a confidential informant, which means you're by definition a private citizen working in conjunction with the federal government, or you're an FBI agent. Well, what the Inspector General report didn't clarify is how many agents were in plain clothes in the crowd. That's what they won't tell us.
Right.
And so there's a lot of confusing information intentionally. So what court is this? Is this like in the D.C. Circuit? Are y'all down in where you're from? Where is this court?
No, it's the D.C. Circuit.
Okay. That's like problem number one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's why, who can get a fair trial in Washington, D.C.?
Not unless you're a Democrat.
Forget it. Right. And 100% of those jurors, I guarantee you, were. And in fact, the jury selection was unbelievable. I mean, the judge had to ask three times, do you think you can put aside your views just this one time? Well, I don't think so. I'm afraid. I'm afraid when Trump supporters come to Washington, D.C., I'm afraid for my safety. Do you think you could put that aside? No, I really don't think I can. Are you sure? Maybe just this one time. That happened multiple times. For the judge to ask in that line of questioning to seat these jurors was completely biased. And even at the direct appeal, Judge Patricia Millett, who happens to be appointed by Obama, said that this was wrong. She said in the direct appeal that this was wrong. Those jurors should not have been seated. Yet, here my husband is, still in jail.
Well, and the question really shouldn't be, can you set aside your bias for this one time? The proper questioning for jurors is, do you have bias? Does the bias exist at all? Because how subjective is that to expect them? By definition, you can't set your bias. Bias is bias. You can't just like check it in and check it out. So that whole line of questioning is flawed to begin with. If you have bias at all, doesn't matter what day of the week it is, you shouldn't play a part in a jury pool. And then the trial, you mentioned during the break, some of these last minute charges with your husband wearing this vest. Tell us about that.
So the day before his sentencing, we received an email from the judge or attorneys that he planned on a 6-year enhancement for a bulletproof vest NYPD issued that my husband had on, that he wore both for warmth, but also to address any counter protesters, Antifa type individuals that day that may have tried to hurt him. And that was a justified fear because we know about a month earlier that Antifa did come and bring violence to the Capitol against Trump supporters. So that's why he wore it. But the judge claimed that Tom was emboldened and he wore that vest thinking that he was going to assault police officers that day, which is completely ridiculous. So he slapped Tom with a 6-year enhancement.
Wow.
10-year sentence total.
So that's how you go from 4 to 10.
Yes. Yes. Wow. And the government wanted 17 years. And they offered Tom a plea deal of 8 years. And he turned that down immediately because he was innocent. And his story didn't change from the moment he was interviewed by the FBI when he turned himself in. The story never changed. Our attorney did not believe us until he saw that video that the government withheld until 1 week before his trial.
Yeah, and on that video, you can't make a plausible argument on behalf of the government that, we just didn't have access to this video. No. No, they were doing sophisticated, really foreign terror operation type techniques with the whole dragnet, which anybody who doesn't know about this, They basically drag the entire city for cell phone data. Mm-hmm. They can ping your phone, tell you exactly where you are, up to like 3 square feet. So they were using like the best of the best in the field of law enforcement, the best of the best technologies to identify people, to hence they found your husband, to scrape footage. I mean, to tell me you don't have that one video shot that you mentioned they found later of the officer hitting your husband, that's just not true. And if it is true, how embarrassing that is that on behalf of the prosecutorial team that they don't have all the footage? Like, exactly. How long have you guys been working on this and you don't have all the footage? Well, not to mention the cover-up of the footage.
Right.
Which y'all probably dealt with. Everybody who's in on this dealt with this, where the Capitol Police would not release the footage. So talk about that.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable that we did not have this footage and that the judge was lied to also. I mean, the prosecution lied to the judge multiple times about this camera footage, this proof that existed, about a case being closed regarding a shooting. They lied on multiple times to the judge. And it's just horrible what was done. And this entire case, Tom was overcharged. His constitutional rights were violated. The jails that he was in were horrendous conditions. Where he is now, thankfully, is a good place, and I thank God for that.
Considering the circumstances.
Exactly, considering the circumstances. But
one thing I want to point out is this is what happens, two things. This is what happens when a politicized law enforcement agency, being the DOJ and the FBI, when they're told from Biden directly with they had all a task force. But when you're told by Garland and Biden, basically, in code speak, hey, we want you to lock up as many people as possible for as long as possible, and whatever you got to do to get there, do what you got to do. I mean, this is what happens when prosecutors and detectives and law enforcement, they use everything possible, even things out of context, even statutes that were not meant for 14-second citizen on law enforcement altercations. They just throw everything at them. And so this is the concern is it's one thing to have, you know, our constitutional rights, but when you've got bad people in charge, there's nobody in there to check them. And clearly, y'all have appealed this multiple times. So the reason I bring this up, this stresses the importance of having constitutional originalist judges that can check these people, right?
Correct. And I mean, I cannot wait for Pam Bondi, Kash Patel to come in and make this right. Because right now we've got some very corrupt people at the top, and you're exactly right. That's what happened. They were told what to do. The judges were told what to do, what the sentence should be. I'm completely convinced.
Yeah. Yeah, and the D.C. Circuit, it's corrupt, it's problematic on multiple fronts. But folks, this is like the country club. I mean, this is the country club. This goes back to the Russiagate hoax. All the people, all the prosecutors, all the U.S. attorneys, all the FBI, they all hang out together. They're buds, they're pals with the judges. I mean, we saw the Peter Strzok was, you know, having, you know, wine parties with the judges that were doing the FISA stuff. So you can't expect accountability when people are so personally conflicted. But the last thing I want to say, once again, we're talking to Michelle Webster, whose husband Tom is currently serving time on some of these amped up charges on January 6th, which hopefully and prayerfully will get a pardon by President Trump. But this could have, thank God, and I mean this, it's seriously and sincerely, that President Trump was elected. And if I feel this way, I know you guys do. But this is why elections are important. Because I don't even want to fathom what your husband would continue to go through had Kamala Harris been elected. I mean, this corrupt Democrat Party apparatus has been an unmitigated disaster on multiple fronts. And people like your husband, Tom, are suffering the consequences of elections. That's Obama's famous quote, consequences. Elections have consequences. So, Michelle, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, Michelle Webster's been our guest today. Her husband, Tom, is currently serving time. And Lord willing, we'll get a pardon from President Trump. I think it's got to happen very quickly. I also think the FBI, should they be sued directly for these this misconduct, I think they need to settle with every January 6th defendant and settle for an amount that pays 100% of all the legal fees and damages that they've suffered over the last 4 years. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.